Taya Obrett's first novel, The Tiger's Wife, came out earlier this year. And the praise has been extreme and pretty universal for its writerly skill as it shifts between realism and fairy tale-ish fable, and for its sense of deep wisdom about memory, faith, family, and death. And then there's the astonishing fact of Taya Obrett's age. She just turned 26. Last summer, she won the British Orange Prize, given annually to the best English language novel by a woman. And now The Tiger's Wife is one of five works of fiction nominated for this year's National Book Award. Taya Obrett, you young person, you, welcome to Studio 360 and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So there are several distinct stories going on in The Tiger's Wife. When somebody you meet on an airplane, let's say, asks you, "Well, so what's your novel about?" What do you say?
Well, I say that it's a novel that takes place in an unnamed province of the former Yugoslavia, which is where I'm from, and that it follows a young doctor named Natalia who is coming to terms with the circumstances of her grandfather's death, which are pretty mysterious, and involve her reflecting on stories that he told her about his childhood and about his time as a doctor when he met this vagabond named the Deathless Man.
At what age did you begin writing fiction?
I started writing when I was 8. I wrote my first short story, I was just sort of getting used to the English language. And I liked the way the word goat looked. It was a very attractive word for me. I thought that it had depth and many different kinds of letters. So I wrote a short story about a goat. And we were living in Cyprus at the time. And my mother had this ancient laptop computer. And you sort of had to drum down on the keys with your fists. And I wrote the story. And I took it to my mother and said, "This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write."
And she said, "Sure.
That's great." She was like, "Sure, all right." Yeah. And that sort of became became the path.
And is it true, as I've read, that one of the ways you learned English was watching VHS cassettes of old Disney movies?
Yeah, I learned English off of, you know, bootleg Disney movies, and I knew the dialogue, you know, from beginning to end. But I had no idea what the characters were saying, so I would go around like a parrot, you know, walk around the house and repeat the lines of dialogue, which my mother found extraordinarily annoying.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we think of, the great mythic storytelling tradition of the Balkans and Eastern Europe and Egypt. But, you know, it sounds as though perhaps the Walt Disney Corporation's version of myth and fable might have been one of the influences that you drew on.
I think that it certainly is. I mean, I liked fairy tales as a child, and they were pretty good at adapting fairy tales. I do think, however, that there is such a thing as a Disney-fied fairy tale.
For sure.
I think that I was always drawn, and I don't know what this says about me, but I was always drawn to the real fairy tale,
right?
You know, to the grim version
the violent, sad, grim ones. Yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't exactly see, you know, in Snow White, you don't see the queen strapped into iron shoes and then forced to, you know, walk until she kills her, you know, until she walks herself to death. And
yeah.
I always, you know, thought that kind of macabre thing was fascinating. Like, how could people come up with this?
Yeah.
It's so awful. And I found it sort of richer and more complex, and it said more about people. And so I was more drawn to that version of the story almost always.
As you're writing this book, which veers and almost seamlessly shifts back and forth between these fable-like mythic environments and events and fairly straightforward realism, is it tricky? Do you require a different kind of writerly trance to do those two kinds of writing?
I think so. I was never... That must be the case, because I was never able to switch from one section of the book to another in a single writing period.
Huh.
If I was writing a tiger section, I could continue with other tiger sections. You know, I could skip to a different section with the tiger and his wife. I could skip to a Deathless Man section, but I would not be able to skip back to one of Natalia's sections.
Right.
And Natalia's sections were written almost... all of them rewritten entirely after the book had already been through one round of edits. Because I happened to go vampire hunting in Serbia and Croatia for a nonfiction piece that I did for Harper's.
Right.
And inadvertently did a whole bunch of research that I didn't realize I needed, but that enriched the book tremendously.
So wait a sec. Vampire hunting. Harper's Magazine sends you to the land of your birth and the land of vampires to do an article about the folklore surrounding them. When you show up there, do you feel like it's a homecoming, or are you just this American outsider doing an article?
I did feel like an outsider, but not because I was an American. You know, the communication part aspect was not a barrier. It was the getting people to admit to something, because people were very shy about their superstitions, and they were aware that this would be perceived as a superstition,
right,
and could potentially be a minefield of mockery.
Right.
The thing that people were most concerned about when we spoke to them about vampires and superstitions and beliefs was for us to understand that during Tito's time, during Tito's regime, none of these beliefs existed. And that was because people were stable and happy and didn't have a need for ridiculous notions of vampirism and superstitions. And several people told us this, most of them, you know, between the ages of 70 and 95. And it was very interesting. It was something that
that's fascinating.
It happened,
because one, of course, as you know, in the 90s, one thought and then read that, of course, Tito kept by being an atheist communist, kept a lid on all of these roiling religious tensions. But I never thought that he also kept a lid on the other half of the mythic superstition pot, you know, about vampires and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, apparently, because, I mean, that has to do with the fact that I think religion, Christian, Judeo-Christian Muslim religion in its, you know, in its sort of blanket terms the way we see it today, that is predated by these deep pagan roots that persist from Croatia to Serbia to Bosnia to Slovenia to Montenegro, everywhere,
right,
because they're very much the same. You know, you get rid of a vampire in Serbia the same way you get rid of a vampire in Croatia, and they may be different words, but it's the same thing. That was a very fascinating thing to learn and very heartening in a way.
Yeah. So for the last few months, you have been and are the sort of it girl of literature. It's true. You can laugh, but it's true. Is that completely gratifying, or is there any downside at all, or is it just as wonderful and Cinderella-like as one might imagine?
The fact that the book exists and that people have read it is Cinderella-like. Because of my own personal nature, which is to doubt everything and fear everything, and, you know, immediately after a good thing happens, like, you know, in Balkan culture, it's you find $5 on the floor, and the next thing you pick them up. And
right,
the next thing you know, you are getting run over by a train.
Right.
And because that is how the world works karmically. So I have some trepidations about...
Right.
About having this book afford me the life that I wanted. I mean, I wanted to be able to write, and now I get to write a second book, and that's ridiculous to me. And I, you know, somewhere deep in my core, I believe that that's going to come with some form of payment, and I
right,
really, really would rather not know what that is.
I think you have at least a couple of complete duds before they'll take away the chance. Yeah, but thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
The Tiger's Wife was just nominated for a National Book Award. You can hear my interviews with some of this year's other National Book Award nominees, including Stephen Greenblatt, author of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, and the late Manning Marable on his biography of Malcolm X. That's at Studio360.org.